of it. Did they tell you, hey, you have a right to not sign this thing? The arbitration agreements cannot contain any language that prohibits or discourage the resident or anyone else from communicating with state or federal local officials. They're not supposed to tell a resident or their family members, hey, you have to sign this thing. Otherwise, you can't be admitted here or you can't stay here. That's a no-no. They're not supposed to do that.
Hey out there, welcome back to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob. I will be your host for this episode. This week we have an excellent topic, something that I can geek out about for a long time, and that is fighting arbitration agreements in nursing home cases. Today we're not talking about arbitration in general. If you want to know about the arbitration, how arbitration works, and why typically it's not great for residents, check the show notes. We have other episodes. We're going to get, we're only talking about legal and policy arguments to fight arbitration in nursing home cases today, but we're not doing that alone. We have an excellent attorney. His name is Ben Reyes. Ben Reyes is going to be joining us to talk about arbitration agreements today. All right. Before we get into it, we're going to do the nursing home regulation question of the week. And I've tried to record this about 15 times, so I'm going to just stick to the script and see if I can put two sentences together. All right. So again, every week we have a giveaway. From now on, we'll be giving away a fantastic coffee mug every single week to one lucky winner. It says for me to hold up my hand. So you put the cup there. Bink. Gene, can you put the cup in my hand? Great. All right. That cup could be yours. How to win? Super simple. Go to our TikTok, which is at Justice for Residents, and look for the weekly question clip. So you go to at Justice for Residents, and you try to find this clip to comment on to win the mug. And I guess, I don't know, maybe at some point this will make sense to me, but I guess when you go, I'm assuming that you're going to see a whole bunch of my bald head. How are you going to know which video to pick on or to click on to win this prize? I guess this is only for people that really want a coffee mug that has Nursing Home Abuse Podcast written on it. But that's how you do it. Go to TikTok at Justice for Residents, find the question of the week, and type the answer, the correct answer, and also your favorite Denzel Washington movie. That is the clue for this week. So you're gonna find the video, put the correct answer, put in your favorite Denzel Washington movie, which for me would be The Equalizer. The Equalizer. You thought it was going to be Ricochet. That's a deep cut, but it's not. It's The Equalizer. Question this week, I'm going to say, is medium difficulty. So if you get it right, you get a couple extra spoons of sugar in your coffee. So here we go. Under 42 CFR 483.25D, what must a facility do to prevent falls and injuries? Is it A, only monitor residents with known fall history, B, install grab bars in bathrooms upon resident request, or C, assess each resident's risk factors and provide adequate supervision and assistive devices? And that answer is C. The nursing home must always assess every resident's risk of fall and provide adequate interventions to prevent those falls. So again, if you want to win, TikTok, favorite Denzel Washington movie, and the answer is C. And hopefully at the end of the month, you'll get a coffee mug. So now let's get into all things arbitration. Actually, all things fighting arbitration, really. We got Ben Reyes on the show. Ben is a trial lawyer and a partner at PKSD Law, representing victims of serious personal injury and nursing home abuse, licensed in New Mexico, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Texas, the four-timer. He has extensive experience litigating nursing home arbitration disputes in state and federal courts, a longtime member of the AAJ, that's the American Association of Justice, Nursing Home Litigation Group. He is also a graduate of the Jerry Spence Method. He also just recently became the father to a beautiful baby girl who's 5 months old. And with that, Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I've been wanting to have this episode for a long time. I've had, I don't know, a half dozen episodes about arbitration itself and why it is not necessarily a good thing for the consumer or the nursing home resident. But I don't think I've really had an episode that's hyper-focused on policy arguments and legal arguments and how to oppose them, how to get people out of these agreements. So that's, I'm super excited about this episode. So we can skip. If anybody doesn't know what an arbitration agreement is, I'll link in the show notes and we can point you in the direction of other episodes where we literally talk about arbitration. This, we're getting into the meat and potatoes now. So Ben, I'm going to throw it to you. What are some of the things, some of the arguments that you're making in order to make sure that your clients don't have to arbitrate their claims against nursing homes?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think the thing that comes up most often for us is the terms of the actual arbitration agreement themselves are usually what we call substantively unconscionable. I mean, that's a huge issue in that the people who are drafting these arbitration agreements, they are drafting them to their advantage, to only their advantage of the nursing home. You know, they're corporate folks up high in the chain at maybe a nursing home chain. And they're trying to make sure that these agreements are as favorable to them as they can possibly be and as unfavorable to nursing home residents and their families as they can possibly be. And as much as they can possibly get away with, they will try and do that. So, you know, you see that a lot of times in these chain nursing and assisted living facility contracts that it's pretty clear that this was somebody out of state who drafted this agreement, who was hoping for it to be very broad, was hoping for it to be as enforceable as they possibly can against a family who is looking to, you know, seek justice for their loved one who's either been severely injured or killed as a result of something that's happened under the nursing home's watch. And so at least where I practice primarily is in New Mexico, where we are seeing a lot of success in attacking these nursing home agreements, arbitration agreements, is in the substantive unconscionability realm. And what that really means is, are the terms of the agreement itself so unfair, so unreasonably and unfairly one-sided in favor of one party, such that a court reviewing the language of the agreement can set this aside and say, no, we're not going to enforce this. This is simply, as a policy matter, this is not something that we want to be doing. And therefore, we're not going to enforce this. The family or the resident can proceed with their claims in state court or federal court, and wherever that may be. So we're seeing making a lot of headway with those these days. There are some very good procedural unconscionability arguments that can be made. And even within the last 2 weeks, I've had some luck in New Mexico State Court with getting a judge to set aside an arbitration agreement based on the findings of fact that we put before him.
Sure.
About the circumstances surrounding the execution of this arbitration agreement by the resident herself.
So help out a fellow member of the bar that's not practicing in a state that's in the Ninth Circuit. We typically are not able to successfully make unconscionability arguments in the South as a whole, but specifically in Georgia. So what are some of the examples that you see in terms of it being the agreement being substantively unconscionable? Like, what are some examples?
Yeah. So one of the most common examples that we see, and this is both in, I practice in primarily in two states, New Mexico and Wisconsin, and we see these in both states. We see a lot of provisions in these arbitration agreements that exempt collections or small claims actions that are brought by residents. In other words, the facility is saying, if you, resident, or your family, if you have a beef and we screwed up and we were negligent and we killed your loved one, you have to arbitrate that. Okay. There's no question. You have agreed to arbitrate that. You don't get to be in state court. You don't get to have a jury of your peers, you know, listen to the evidence and render a decision. That has to be arbitrated. But if we, the facility, have a collection action against you for unpaid bills, or if we want to get you removed from the facility for that same reason or for any other reason, we don't have to arbitrate that. So it essentially creates an avenue for the nursing facility to be able to bring its most likeliest claims and precludes the resident from bringing the claims they're most likely to bring. Because I would be shocked if you'd ever see a nursing home resident bring a small claims action against a nursing facility. It's just, I've just never heard of it happening in all my years of practicing. So that's one. So within that collection exemptions, I also would include eviction actions. I think I mentioned that. Another big issue that we're seeing recently is, does it waive statutory remedies that would otherwise be available to the resident or to their family? In New Mexico, we see that attorney's fees are allowable under consumer protection statutes if there's found to be a violation of the Unfair Practices Act. So if there are limitations in the agreement about, you cannot recover attorney's fees or you can't recover those in any kind of arbitration that proceeds, that may be unconscionable. And we've had some luck with attacking even delegation clauses on that issue alone. You know, for instance, if you file a lawsuit and the defendants come into court and they try and file a motion to compel arbitration and they remove the case to federal court, there may not be any ability for a plaintiff or resident family member to be able to seek attorney's fees for that, for even for the process of having to go to an arbitrator to get the ruling that the arbitration agreement as a whole is unconscionable. So I've seen some recent case law in our state that suggests that in and of itself, excluding attorney's fees in that scenario, even when the arbitrator is the one who ultimately has to decide if it's an enforceable agreement, even those get set aside. So that can be a potential avenue. Another big one is a limitation on damages. We're seeing a lot of agreements that have either an express limitation, say, you cannot recover more than, say, $250,000 or $500,000 for any type of damages. That's one thing we see. But more frequently, what we're seeing is limitations on punitive damages or an outright exclusion for punitive damages. And at least in New Mexico, that's a pretty big no-no. Courts don't look kindly upon that because, again, you have a generally unsophisticated resident or their family who likely have never been to a nursing home or admitted to a nursing home, gone through the process of getting their loved one admitted. And here you have them signing a piece of paper that says, not only are you waiving your right to a jury trial, but if we really screw up and we're reckless or, do something intentional that warrants punitive damages, then you can't recover those in the arbitration. So that's one way to attack these. In Wisconsin, we see a lot of agreements that limit the statute of limitations date or shorten the statute of limitations date, which can be particularly tough for us attorneys coming in after the fact. If a family member hasn't come in, and spoken to us for a couple months, or sometimes, occasionally we get calls even a year or more after something has happened, that can create problems for us. And we've had some arguments with statute of limitations shortening.
So thank you for that. And so when you're attacking the arbitration agreement based on unconscionability in New Mexico or Wisconsin, that is being heard by the arbitrator, or is that kind of an ab initio contract formation where a judge can hear that? Like who is deciding whether or not it's unconscionable?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in our scenario, what I'm talking about is always the judge. So the typical way this works is we file suit, the defendants come in within the statutory timeframe, and they either file an answer or they file a motion to compel arbitration right away. And then we're having it out with the judge via motion practice and a hearing about whether this thing is enforceable in the first place. So these are arguments that can be made to a judge, depending on whether the judge is inclined to rule on that based on the delegation clause, which we can talk about later on. But these are arguments that are being made to a judge. And I think, frankly, you're better off as an attorney representing victims of nursing home abuse. You're better off in state court than you are in arbitration. I think we all kind of take that maybe for granted. But that's who we want to be deciding these issues, are the state court judges who are more amenable to the idea And they know what, you know, they know what's going on. They know that these poor people are being railroaded by these large nursing home companies that really want to, you know, CYA. And so they, the judges are amenable to listening to these arguments in those situations. So yeah, these are arguments that are being made to a judge initially, at the outset of the case before we get into any of the meat of it. So that's what's going on.
Okay, so tell me then, let's a good segue into delegation. Like, what do you mean delegation clauses?
Yeah, so all nursing home defendants want to put their cases into arbitration so that they can delay. And as most of the you know, practicing nursing home attorneys who listen to this know, they've experienced that firsthand. This they want to drag it out. They want to make this take as long as it possibly can. So what is a delegation clause? It's a clause that delegates certain issues to an arbitrator. And so what you'll typically see is a provision in the arbitration agreement that says any issues regarding the making, the enforcement, or defenses to contracting regarding this arbitration agreement should be decided by an arbitrator. That's typically the language that we see in these delegation clauses. And so courts generally are, I think you start from the initial premise that courts are to decide these issues about whether an agreement is enforceable when it's presented to them in a case like this, unless there is really clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties intended to delegate that threshold issue to an arbitrator. So fighting those delegation clauses is really sometimes it's the initial battle. It's the battle before the big battle,
And that's,
so to
and I
speak.
get, is another way of saying that arbitrability is that, or did I just make that up? That's, it's
No,
literally,
absolutely.
literally who enforces the contract? Is it the arbitrator or the judge? And I guess, and because I'm not making a lot of these, just because of the state that I'm in, not making a lot of unconscionability arguments. All of mine are most of mine are contract formation, which ab initio is a court, not an arbitrator. There, it's like, is there a contract at all, as opposed to what's the scope of the contract that we agree exists? So that's an interesting thing. So yeah, so you're fighting sometimes arbitrability. I get it. Okay.
Right. Yeah, and it's not just whether so like I think of traditional arbitrability as, well, is this the type of claim that falls within the arbitration agreement scope? You know, and generally any kind of negligence or recklessness claim or injury claim or wrongful death claim is going to fall within that. It is you know, an arbitrable claim under that agreement. This is more, you know, the making, the enforceability, defenses to contracting, that if you're lucky enough to have a judge here, these are the arguments that we can then make. And you know, we find that the current case law requires really some kind of attack on the delegation clause, usually. At least in New Mexico, the case law is always changing, but we're finding that, you know, there has to be an attack that's specific to the delegation clause itself, or you can challenge the whole agreement, but it has to, the challenge that you're making to the agreement also has to apply to the delegation clause. So it can get very complex when you're dealing with the delegation clause, and it doesn't make any sense in some ways, because you're having a court decide that the arbitrator is the one who has to decide whether this thing is enforceable, even though there might be very clear language or evidence in the contract that shows that this thing is unenforceable under existing law, under existing precedent. It just seems so such a waste of time to me to be having a court say, well, this is the arbitrator has to decide this. And of course, the arbitrator has, you know, some incentive to decide that the arbitration agreement is enforceable, so that the arbitrators can then hear the case. You know, they are getting paid. They are getting paid for their time, which is another issue that, you know, you don't have in state court. So there's always the delegation clause issue that requires at least some initial research to see, you know, what does it say in your state about does a delegation clause have to be challenged directly? What is the status of the case law on that issue?
Speaking of complexity, there is now, I say now, in the last 5 years or so, 5 or 6 years, I guess, now, nowadays, specifically dealing with the scope of arbitration agreements and how the arbitration agreements are brought to the residents under federal regs. Tell me about your experience in using the arbitration, the federal regulations regarding arbitration in trying to defeat enforcement of arbitration agreements.
Sure. So there are a couple of regs that are on point that speak to this issue of arbitration agreements, because obviously the federal government has realized that this is an issue. And CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, understands that's an issue. So there are provisions in the administrative code, the federal code of federal regulations at 42 CFR 48370 that speak to arbitration agreements and how they have to go about obtaining a resident's consent for that. Now, I will say this at the outset. So these provisions don't allow us to go into court and say, well, if they violated this provision, then this thing is per se unenforceable, or, you know, a court cannot enforce that. What they do for us, however, are provide us some ammunition to say, look, judge, there are federal regulations that are on point that a nursing home must comply with in order to have a resident sign an enforceable arbitration agreement. And for instance, some of the requirements they have in place are a nursing home must not require a resident or her representative to sign an agreement for binding arbitration as a condition of admission. So they're not supposed to tell a resident or their family members, hey, you have to sign this thing, otherwise you can't be admitted here or you can't stay here. That's a no-no. They're not supposed to do that. They also must explicitly inform the resident or the representative of their right not to sign the arbitration agreement. Okay, so that's something that we dig into with our clients when we have the initial meeting with them about the arbitration agreement is, tell me about the circumstances of it. Did they tell you, hey, you have a right to not sign this thing? Or did they simply, you know, slide it in there in an 80-page stack of documents with everything else and say, sign here, sign here, and here? Another requirement is that they have to show that the agreement was explained to the resident or the representative. They also have to acknowledge that the resident understands the agreement for binding arbitration. They have to provide for the selection of a neutral arbitrator agreed upon by both parties and the selection of venue that is convenient to both parties. They must explicitly grant the resident the right to rescind the agreement within 30 calendar days of signing it. They must also, the arbitration agreements cannot contain any language that prohibits or discourage the resident or anyone else from communicating with state or federal local officials. In other words, you know, they cannot put anything in the arbitration agreement that prevents the family from reporting, you know, a violation of the regulations to state or federal authorities. I mean, in pretty much every state that we practice in, there's some kind of overseeing state authority here that is responsible for regulating nursing facilities and regulating, you know, citations and issuing citations and things of that nature. So they cannot prohibit that in an arbitration agreement. So these are regulations that the facility could be cited for violating during a survey, which I think most of your listeners probably understand the survey process. But it does not create these provisions in the federal code do not create a private right of action if the facility violates this, but they can be very powerful in demonstrating to a court that the circumstances of execution demonstrate that this was procedurally unconscionable.
I want to make sure that I've digested this. So we have a certain amount of requirements. The person has to be explained. It has to be explicit. It can't be buried under subparagraph 7041 or whatever. Et cetera, et cetera. The ramifications of not following these regulations is that the nursing home can be cited. It has nothing to do with with whether or not it's a valid arbitration agreement. But you're telling the judge, look, judge, just the same as the nursing home has to do a care plan within a certain amount of days or assess the resident within a certain amount of days or it gets cited, that's saying that's the standard of care, but it's just the same. It's just as important. And that is working in terms of arguments with judges in New Mexico.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it almost put it in, yes, what you just said is absolutely correct. And I think the way to think of it is it almost creates, if you look at that provision, it almost creates a roadmap for arguing procedural unconscionability, because some of the factors that if you look at most state law on procedural unconscionability, it almost tracks exactly the elements that courts look at to determine if something's procedurally unconscionable. And, you know, this comes up a lot in the consumer context, where people are buying a product, or, you know, purchasing a service or something along those lines, where a court is looking at it after the fact and saying, well, what does this explain? What are the circumstances leading up to the signing of this? So you're correct in your statement. It's something the facility must do, but it's not necessarily going to be the kill shot, so to speak, for the arbitration agreement for us plaintiff lawyers.
I think I'm a little slow on the uptick, but I think it's coming to me. So it's not necessarily you're not arguing a motion like, hey, they violated these regs and therefore X. It's the violation of those regs is a part of your unconscionability argument. Okay, I get it.
Correct.
That makes sense. Okay, so that requires then that when you go in front of the judge with your response to their motion to compel, you're asking for a limited amount of time to conduct discovery limited to the arbitration. And then you're deposing whoever the admission person is. Hey, do you normally do X, or what is arbitration, or et cetera? Can you walk me kind of generally through who are you deposing? Kind of like, what are you wanting to know to put into your, you know, your ultimately your response motion?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So we in pretty much every single case we have involving an arbitration agreement, we are asking to conduct some initial discovery, or asking for a stay of the case in some fashion or another in order to conduct some discovery. And so what we generally do is we'll conduct some written discovery, asking for policies and procedures about the process of having the facility get the resident to sign the agreement. You know, some facilities will have explicit language that they give to an admissions person or to a marketing coordinator. Whoever's responsible for getting pen to paper from that resident so that they can get heads in the beds, whoever that person is, we want to know how have they been informed about going about this process of getting a signature on an arbitration agreement. So it starts with that, usually some basic written discovery, but then it also involves sitting down and taking depositions of these individuals, usually of the person whoever signs on behalf of the facility. So we want to identify that from the get-go, usually in the written discovery, or simply from, you know, conversing with the defense attorney on the case. And then we want to sit down and take that person's deposition. And those depositions can be extremely interesting and fun, because a lot of times, and I've learned this from other folks who are involved with nursing home litigation, from the nursing home litigation group, that, you know, you oftentimes find that these folks, they don't really understand what they're asking these residents to sign. That they're told, hey, you got to get these admissions done, get these all done today, get this paperwork signed, get them in there, heads in the beds. You know, that's the idea. And so we're talking to these folks and asking them, you know, tell me about what you recall about, you know, meeting my client and going through this process of getting him or her to sign the arbitration agreement. And very often they have no recollection of it. And if they do, they claim to, they're usually not telling the complete truth, I will say, because what you see is that they have so many residents and they're asking all of these residents to sign these arbitration agreements. And you're talking about a, you know, 100 or 120 bed facility. That's thousands and thousands of arbitration agreements that these admissions people have gone through. And so they generally have a procedure that they will go through, and they will recall some of that. They won't have a recollection generally of your client, based on the number, the volume that they go through. But oftentimes you realize that they are not capable of explaining the ins and outs of the arbitration agreement themselves to a resident, because they don't understand them. And so that can be very critical in establishing that, for instance, going back to these federal regulations we talked about, that can be critical in establishing that those weren't followed, that it wasn't explained, that they didn't tell the person, hey, you have the right to have this reviewed by a lawyer before signing it. Hey, you know, you don't have to sign this as a condition of admission. I mean, more often than not, what we hear from our clients is that we're told, you know, sign here, sign here, sign here, sign here. And they went through it very quickly, as anybody who's ever, you know, purchased a home or, you know, made some kind of a large contractual purchase, they can tell you. I mean, it's go through the paperwork and get it done. And that's kind of how this goes down. So, yeah, we're almost always deposing the person who's signed the admission agreement on behalf of the facility, so that we can establish A, that they likely have no recollection of this person. So they're not going to be able to come into court and say otherwise, say, oh, I remember specifically, I sat down with Mrs. Smith on March 7th of 2025, and we spoke for an hour and I explained this to her. We want to box that out, but we also want to establish that they really don't take the time to explain this, and that the residents don't understand what they're signing. So that all goes to the procedural unconscionability.
I recently was successful in fighting a motion to compel arbitration, and it was it was almost a 100-page admission agreement, electronically signed, quote unquote. And you in the whatever you call the certification that has like the time, things like that. It tells you how long the document was opened before it was signed, and it was like 60 seconds, but there was like 15 places to initial. So like, if you did the math, it was like the person was initialing something every 3 seconds, or there's no way that anybody could have comprehended anything in the documents. So voluminous. And that certificate, they gave it to us. That's it. I mean, that's when they opened it, when they signed it, et cetera, the IP address. So, I mean, you're right. Heads and beds. I mean, that's a lot of times what it's all about. Ben, I can geek out on this stuff all day. We didn't even get to capacity or authority. We'll have to have you on at some other time to talk about those as defenses to arbitration agreements. But we've been going for a while now. But I really, really, first of all, I appreciate you coming on the show, but also congratulations. I understand that you had a baby girl.
I did. She's 5 months as of 3 days ago, and she's healthy and happy, and it's been a huge blessing. So thank you so much.
Congratulations, man. That's awesome. Is this your first kid?
It's our first kid. So we're learning as we go, and it's been so fun and scary at times, but I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Amazing, man. Well, enjoy the sleepless nights. It's gonna last for a little while longer.
I'm sure. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Folks, I hope you found that this episode educational and entertaining. If you have an idea for a topic that you would like for me to cover, please let me know. If you have an idea for a guest that you would like for me to speak to, let me know that as well. New episodes of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast, for the time being, come out every week on Mondays. Make sure that you visit, I guess, YouTube or the website, and you can see, I think this might be the 240-something episode. So we got a bunch of stuff. So if you enjoy this episode and you want to learn more, go and check out the back catalog. It's growing and growing every week. But I guess is that it? Yeah, I think that's about it. All right, everybody. With that, we'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said on this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal or medical advice, nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes, for now, are available every other Monday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.